Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the 7th episode of the 3rd season of Sukoon. Sukoon is going through a reimagining into a new series brought to you by Nazimco, where we explore the rich history, challenges, and successes of the North American Shia Muslim community. In each episode, we'll sit down with leaders and pioneers who have helped shape our community, contributing to its growth and development over the years. Today, we are honored to have with us someone who needs no introduction. He has appeared everywhere, from your living room on the Shia Voice, to reciting lakmiyas at your local jamaat, to hosting many of the remarkable Shia conferences we've attended. He has inspired an entire younger generation to recite and express their love of the Ahlul Bayt and have confidence in their faith. At a recent Shia conference, someone actually did tell me, "Is it even a Shia conference if Ali Fadl doesn't recite?" Please join me in welcoming our guest, Mullah Ali Fadl. Salams, Brother Ali, and thank you for joining us today.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah. That was one of the most colorful introductions that I've ever had. Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Of course. So could you tell us a little bit about yourself? Where were you born? Where were you raised? And what did you study?
Okay, so not to get into the boring details of where I was born, you could say I was born in Iran, in Qom, but I moved to the UK when I was about one and a half, two, so I don't really actually remember anything to do with where I was born or anything like that, obviously, but I grew up in the UK, in London. For 20 years, interestingly, for 20 years, I was in one house, growing up in one neighborhood. And I remember it was not that much of a rough neighborhood, but I remember kind of growing up in school, I would see the troublemakers. And when I leave school, or for example, in the evening, or when I'm going out to the shop or whatever like that, I'd see the same troublemakers making trouble outside. But because I've grown up in the neighborhood and they've seen me and they've regularly seen me, it's like, this guy is safe. I mean, it was a bit of a rough neighborhood, so it's like, okay, this guy is safe, we know him, we know what he's about, we know where he lives. So that I grew up in a neighborhood slightly rough for 20 years, and then another 16 years was in another neighborhood which was a bit more quieter and calmer. So that was UK London. That's where I was born. I frequented a predominantly traditional Shia center called Rasul Al-Azam in Northwest London. And that was the place where all my friends were, all my parents' friends were. We were a very close-knit community. That's essentially where I got my Ahlul Bayt teachings. That was drummed into me from a young age. Other than that, it was my parents, God bless them, where they were the ones that really introduced kind of Ahlul Bayt and Khidmah and everything like that. But because it's interesting, because my parents would say one thing when it comes to Khidmah and service, but then I'd see the application of it in the local mosque. So when I went to the local mosque, I would see what they're talking about. So for example, if they're talking about Latmiyat and lectures and the rituals associated with Imam Hussein alayhi salam, when I go to the local mosque, I see it with my own eyes. So it was both theory that I get from my parents as well as the application in the local mosque. Hope that answers the question.
Yeah. And when you said you grew up in a slightly rough neighborhood, did your parents ever kind of get concerned that you wouldn't, that you would fall into that trap, that you would lose your faith, that you moved from, you know, kind of a Iran to the West and you would lose that Shia faith by integrating into the West and this rougher neighborhood?
So what I think is important to note, and I want the viewers to really consider this point. I said it a few times, and I think it's quite important to understand that when my generation, anyway, or my parents' generation, when they migrated from Iraq, there was thousands and thousands of them that had to flee the country because of the political situation, Saddam Hussein, whatever. Some of them went to Europe, some of them went to Turkey, Syria, but thousands of them, quite a few of them, actually went to London. Now, when they touch base in London, you have to understand a few things. Number one, they don't know the language. They don't know the culture. They don't know the politics. They don't know safety and security. They don't know how to integrate. All they know is what they've grown up with. right? And that's their identity, right? The Shia ritualistic traditional identity. So what do they need to do in order to safeguard the future of their children? I'm talking a specific niche of a community here, my community, the community that I grew up in, Iraqi. Well, Karbala'i Iraqi. So it's niche of a niche, basically, right? So the Karbala natives who used to live in Karbala, they went to London. This is the community I'm talking about, right? And there wasn't that many of them. It's just a couple hundred families. But what they found very, very important that they knew that they had to do is to keep that Shia Imam Hussein identity strong. How did they do that? They created a bit of a bubble around us. So some of them obviously worked and integrated within the society, and they accepted that they live in a foreign land. Some of them actually said, no, I am going to work minimum. I'm going to do my work, but all of my social circles are going to be people that I know. So they established the mosque. When they established the mosque, they obviously established the Husseiniyah. This Husseiniyah, anything that happened in Karbala from a ritualistic perspective, i.e., Latum, i.e., I don't know, chains, for example, i.e., the color, the minbar, the black, the theme, the tea, the everything that they associated with and were comfortable with as their home, they brought into this mosque. So my parents were one of them. So when they, to answer the question, of course they were worried, but they said, look, every Friday we have to go to Rasul Adam. Every single Friday without fail. To the point where I remember sleeping on the way back after a couple of years of going to Rasul Adam. I remember sleeping on the way back. And I know by closing my eyes, I know exactly where we are in the location because they took, obviously, they took the same route every single week. Number one. Number two, my social circles now, my closest friends are friends that I grew up with in the mosque, not outside the mosque. So my closest friends, I don't know any one of them that were in my school. None of them. Not one in primary school, not one in high school, not even one in college, to be honest with you, or even university. None of them. Well, university, yes, because a lot of my friends did, we kind of attended the same university. But growing up, none of my friends were outside of my community. So the people that I associated with now in Rasul, I've known them for 30 odd years, maybe even more, 35 years. So for them, what was very important is a very tight-knit, safe and secure schedule, an agenda, a timetable. School, if I am 1 minute late from school, why are you late? And the school, I could see the school from our apartment. Like I could see the school. So my mom could actually literally stand. If I leave school, she could see me leave the school, walk all the way to the apartment. So that's how much of a lens that they had on the safety and security. Not only from a health perspective, but also from an ideological perspective as well. Of course, they can't have a say. They don't have really have a say what happens in school, what I'm taught in school. What they do have a say is what happens after that. So straight after school, even if I'm 1 minute late, why are you late? I was worried. Blah blah blah. It does kind of create that like, mum, I went to the shop. Like, it's really not that deep. It's not that much of an issue. But for them, it's like, we don't know what the land is like. We don't know what's safe. We don't know what's secure. We don't want to take risks. So yes, they did have a fear. Thankfully, now to answer the specific question on going astray, for example, thankfully, I, from a young age, because I attended these centers, that the elder, the or the ones that are 3, 4, 5 years older than me, who were the ones creating the programs, coordinating the programs, developing these programs for us in English, they allowed me to be within their circles. So whenever they went out on a Friday or they went out on a Saturday, and yes, I mean, I'm old enough to say this, it was like shisha or whatever it was. I sit there, like I'm sitting there as a 15, 16-year-old, but I'm a sponge. Like I'm sitting there and I'm listening to all of these elders. I'm not going to name names. Some of them are within the community. I'm not going to name names, but they allowed, what I really liked about it is they allowed me to just be there. Don't say anything because if you're saying something and you get it wrong, you're going to get ridiculed. But they allowed me to be there. They allowed me to soak in the conversations, the ideas, the thoughts, all of their thinking, I sponged it in and I took it in. So that was kind of my evenings. And because my mom knew these elder generation, then she knows their parents, she was okay to say, okay, go. Like, even to a certain extent, I would sit down. I remember I was in a car with a friend of mine. Actually, maybe we'll touch upon this point later on, but that car ride, well, not, no, that friend of mine was actually the first poet that wrote poetry for me. We can talk about that later, but I used to sit in gatherings where these guys are fully old men Iraqis, and I'm sitting here as an 18-year-old, just like I just want to sit here and just listen to the conversations. Some of them were a bit left field and a bit like, wow, I don't need to listen to that. But some of them were really thought-provoking. But I just sit down and I'm just taking in all of the information. So that's where I was introduced to like world politics and Middle East and Iraqis and scholars and reciters and all of this wonderful world that I had no clue existed, but I was suddenly exposed to it, and that's what created my understanding of the Shia world.
Yeah. So it
And
sounds like
also
there
my
was
mum
really,
allowed me
yeah.
to.
Go ahead.
No, I was saying that's why my mum and dad, for example, they were comfortable knowing where I was and who I was with. And I wasn't telling my mum, yeah, I'm gonna go see this person, whereas I'm going somewhere else. They knew where I was. Did I lie to them? No, I couldn't even lie to them, because the person that I was with, my dad knows him. So my dad could just even say, oh, is Ali with you? And he'd be like, yeah.
They would catch you if you lied.
They would catch me out, yeah. I didn't need to anyway, so it was fine.
Yeah. So is that how you slowly transition to wanting to recite behind the mic, or how did that happen between you becoming, this 14-year-old who's attending the masajid, the centers, to you saying, I think I want to give this a go. I think I have an interest in this. How did that transition happen?
Good question. Very good question. So I'd need to take a step back and understand actually who are my parents, basically. So my father, Sheikh Fadhil Al-Khatib, he's a scholar who's studied in Hausa for a number of years, and still studies in London. He goes around the world lecturing. So he's a lecturer, basically. Your Sheikh Hilli, Sayyid Ammar equivalent, wherever they are, right? Maybe not to not that global stage, but he's an Arabic speaker. Right, he's gone to America, gone to Australia, gone to Europe, gone to Africa, gone to Pakistan. He's gone to hundreds of countries, traveling and speaking. Right. On the other side, my mum has a very unique position in the community. There's not a lot of female reciters, so she recites. See, the Iraqi tradition, there's the male programs that they do in houses or in Husseinias. And then there's the female programs. The female programs play a massive role in the social dynamics of Iraqis living in the West, because that's where females, women, parents, aunties, daughters, whoever, they go there to attend majalis and socialize and be able to create that close-knit community. Yeah. My mother was a reciter, and she was the most prominent reciter, and she is, I can proudly say. Sometimes when you want to talk about yourself, you're like, oh no, you're stop being big-headed, or whatever. But I can talk about my parents. My mother is the most prominent female reciter, I would probably say, globally. No one will understand. Men are obviously not allowed to listen to her, and women outside of the Iraqi community in London, Emirates, maybe Iraq, won't really know her. Yeah, but in the UK, she's traveled as far as America to recite for female-only majalis. She traveled to Europe to recite. She traveled to the Middle East. So she is, and I can proudly say that, the most prominent female reciter. To the extent, by the way, one time I was sitting in, we do some housemate like programs just for families, sitting down, sisters, mom, dad. So my mum was giving a majlis for us. My sister Fatima told me, Ali, there's something special about her voice. Like you don't understand. You haven't sat in a majlis like listening to her. I'm like, what's the big deal? Like, come on, like everyone, there's loads of nice voices. It can't be that special. So then, wallah, I remember the moment that she started just Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, right? You know how you open up a majlis, Bismillah ar-Rahman. She just said Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, sallallahu alayka ya Aba Abdullah, in the tone that she gives in her normal majalis. I kid you not, I'm like, wow. Like, I was like, forget she's my mom for a second, but I'm like, What?
Yeah.
Like I couldn't actually believe that that was her majalis. And that's why when she goes, for example, she travels for Muharram sometimes, and I get so many of my sisters, so my sisters, like so many of our close female friends, so many of them come up to me when we're sitting in family gatherings. They'll say to me, Ali, like, you don't understand. Muharram is not the same without your mom. Like yeah, it's she's got that much of an effect, right? So they again, so two things we need to consider, right? Number one was the society that they built for themselves, the bubble, the Husseini bubble, I would call it. And number two, they're both deep into the whole reciting field. So the recitation field is two forms. Number one is the knowledge, the literature, the Quran, the hadith, the history. And on the other side of that, what we know about Imam Hussein alayhi salam is the tears side of it. So there's an interesting saying in Arabic, is that Imam Hussein alayhi salam is ibra and abra. So if you understand the Arabic grammar, ibra is with a kasra and abra is with a fatha. The kasra makes it ibra, meaning he is Imam Hussein is a source of knowledge, you could say. Like he's a source of wisdom, a source of sayings, a source of information. You can kind of in that field. So to put it simpler, lectures. And the abra is when someone is choking up with tears. So just that word, changing the grammar for it, then automatically changes the two meanings, right? So that is what I grew up with. That Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is both knowledge from my dad's side and the tears from my mom's side. So to answer the question, how did this all come about? They drummed into me, drilled into me, reciters, not singers. They drilled into me speakers, not personalities, people, whatever. I mean, we didn't have YouTube in those days, so I don't really know who was famous, who was not. But they constantly updated our cassettes. Remember cassettes? I don't know. Cassettes or CDs, and then CDs went on to like more digital forms, like
MP3s.
MP3s, and then you had the like, iPods, and then iPods went into phones, and blah blah blah. Right? Back in the day, in my days, I had cassettes. I don't even know if half of viewers even know what cassettes are. Right? We had little tape cassettes. They were this big. They had they, you had to get a pen to rewind to the back or whatever it was. So I had cassettes, right? And the most prominent person I used to listen to, he's still prominent and still a legendary leader in his field today, is Mulla Basim Al-Karbalai. I don't know if you've heard of his name. Yeah, so Mulla Basim, right? So I grew up with listening to Mulla Basim, understanding Mulla Basim. So that was my like, wow. That was my like this guy's amazing. So then I started to say, okay, maybe I can recite. Maybe I've got my mom's voice and not my dad's. Although my dad's voice is amazing, but I'd rather have my mom's voice. But anyway, so my dad said, listen, I used to always attend majalis with my dad anyway. So one time he said to me, Ali, why don't you prepare a poem? Prepare a poem. And I'm gonna ask the host of the majlis if you can recite a few words. So like, okay, fine. So once, twice, three, four, five times. I'm like, yeah, this is I like this. I like the feeling. I liked the people's reaction, all of that stuff. Of course, I'll be very honest. At that age, you don't really understand what you're doing. Half the words are in Arabic, like all of the words are in Arabic. I understood maybe 10% of it, 20% of it. I understood the story overall, but the poem itself wasn't, I'm just reciting it because Mulla Basim recited it. I'm trying to recite it like Mulla Basim. And then I really enjoyed people's feedback. I'll be honest, like that's the way it was. As a 12, 13-year-old, you don't really understand what you're doing. Then it transitioned into what was life-changing for me. And this is what I always tell all the communities, which wherever I go, that you need to set this up. They need to set up a choir. Now, it may sound wishy-washy. It may sound, well, choirs, but a choir is the most perfect way to introduce yourself into the recitation field. What I mean by that is, as an individual reciter, if you're given the opportunity to recite in the Jama'at, in the Husseiniyah, if you don't do well the first time, be it nerves, be it people watching you, be it maybe you haven't prepared well, be it so many things, if you don't perform well, then they will say, oh, this guy's not reciting. But there are so many factors that affect that one performance. Solo. In a choir, your voice gets lost with every other voice because it's a choir. So I started off in what we call light of guidance as a choir. And I hope to God that people don't actually find these tracks anywhere because I was diabolical. Like I was personally, I was horrible. I didn't like it at all. Well, I loved being there, but obviously this is, we're talking 17 years ago, 18 years ago, maybe a very long time, a very, very long time. So, but I started, and what was life-changing for me is that the choir, when we were doing practices, the lead, let's say singer, the lead reciter, he said to me, Ali, you seem to have a very unique voice. Why don't you do a solo part as part of the choir recitation? Okay, no problem. So he would lead, and then there was a verse that I would do solo. So I would step forward and I would do solo. Once, twice, three times, there was one man that was sitting in the crowd. Remember the story that I told you about sitting in the car?
Yeah.
That man was in the crowd one time. He was young. He was probably in his late 20s. And he looked at me, and then he took me to the side after the recitations. He said to me, Ali, let me tell you from now. You have a future in solo recitations. You have a voice, which is fantastic. He goes, I can write you English poetry. Wallah, wallah, till this day, I don't remember the exact day. I don't remember. I remember it was cold, but London's cold all the time. I don't remember the exact day. I remember where it was. It was El Khoi Foundation. We just finished a choir recitation with Light of Guidance. And by the way, I should mention the person that gave me the opportunity was Sajjad Al-Ha'iri, just in case he's watching. Salam Sajjad, thank you so much for the opportunity. Sajjad Al-Ha'iri gave me the opportunity to be part of the choir. And another thing, who were the members of the choir? Only that community that I told you we created that bubble. They were the only people as part of the choir. Some of their voices were horrible. Sorry, guys, if you're listening. Some of their voices were horrible. And some of them were just there to make up numbers. But I think overall, we sounded okay. We sounded all right. We sounded decent. Yeah. Actually, I don't remember specifically, but I think two or three graduated from that Light of Guidance choir to become solo reciters as well. I think I need to see who was inside the system. So it was a very, very fundamental change, a life-changing experience for me. Anyway, fast forward, this guy said to me, he says, Mr. Ali, you need to be a solo reciter. You're gonna lose whatever talent that you have if you carry on with this choir thing. You have what it takes. I can write for you English poetry. When he said that, something clicked. I was like, English? Like, I know we were doing the choir in English, by the way. So we actually reciting in English. And I'm like, English. The thing is, a lot of people in this day and age, they're still uncomfortable. By the way, let me know if I'm talking too much, because I like
no,
to.
No, that's an interesting story about how it came about.
Yeah, so English recitation in this day and age. I mean, I sigh because there are a lot of positives, but there are also negatives as well. And I wish that I can set up a school that I can start teaching young children the rights and the wrongs and the do's and the don'ts of English recitations. But anyway, there still is this uncomfortable nature of reciting. Maybe, I think someone I spoke to now, he's a very prominent Arabic reciter, but he does know English. Like, he's an American, so he knows English. He's like, Ali, the accent is not the same. So when we're reciting in American accent, it's just, it doesn't sound right. And I'm like, I see what you're saying, but there still is that fear. What is that fear? People laughing, people mocking, people taking the mic, people just not really vibing with it. And I get that. I get that. Maybe I was lucky in the sense that I could deliver a recitation that doesn't have that much of a strong accent. Maybe I'm just delivering it in the right way. I don't know. I genuinely don't know. But what I do know is that there is still, even within the UK reciters, they just want to do Arabic because, and another thing, I can go off in so many tangents, but the world of recitations in this day and age, especially the Arabic, has kicked off big time because of social media, because of YouTube. Everything, I wouldn't say commercialized, but everything is now, how do we make this look like a movie? Like, there's cameras and there's editing and there's sound and everything. Like, mate, back in the day, in my days, It was just one camera on you, and you had one rubbish sound system. You could just about make what the words are saying. That was my day, right? But these guys have like the most latest technology when it comes to sound editing and voice and the video, the montage. So when you're looking at this, like even my son, who's like 1 year old, he'll look at a recitation video and he will stare at it for a couple of minutes before he loses interest, but he'll stare at it for a few minutes, thinking, wow, this is great, right? My 8 year old, Hussein, he will sit down and look through a whole 18-minute recitation video because it's just so dynamic. It's just so, but back in the day, it was just one camera, one microphone, whatever technology you have to record it, you record it. Anyway, taking a step back, English recitations, there was this fear. But for me, another step back, I was like, what? I was comfortable with the language. I was comfortable with the accent. I was comfortable, like, I don't know why. Like, a lot of people have fear, but I just genuinely don't know why I didn't have a fear of people ridiculing me. If you ask me now, like, I'm very, this is quite personal, but I'm very aware of what people think of recitations and what people think of my recitation. I'm just very, very aware. Like, I look for feedback and I look for constructive feedback. And that's why I value when someone says to me, Ali, that was rubbish. Like, I genuinely value it. It's like, look, you could do better. You know, you could do better. You could have done this, and that better. Most of the time, it's like, oh, Ali, that was great. That's fantastic. I just put it to the side. Yeah. Now it's more like, Ali, you know what? Knowing what you can do, this is what you need to do better. And that is what I want to give to the next generation. I don't want to sweet talk them. I don't want to give them a comforting hug and say, oh yeah, that was fantastic. That was brilliant. You know what? Your parents can do that. Yeah. Your friends can do that. I want to say, listen, you're great, but you need to work on one, two, and three if you want to go to the next level. Okay. But from my perspective, when I first started off, it was like, I didn't care. Like, I had no fear of people laughing or ridiculing. I knew that I had a raw, passionate voice that needed a bit of toning and it needed a bit of work, but I knew that I could do something, yeah, with the voice. And let me tell you, if I go back to it now, I'm like, cringe, because like, what in the world are you doing? Like, what are you reciting? What are the words that you're reciting? What is that tone? What is that melody? What is that? All of that, I'm like, oh, that sounds disgusting. But hey, it worked at the time, because one, my first, I don't remember, I remember my first ever traveling recitation was going up to Manchester from London. And that was a good maybe 3 hours. That was a horrible journey. Obviously, I'm 18 years old, yeah. So I don't have a car to drive myself. I can't really go by train. I can't really demand that people, not demand, but requests that people arrange my travel plans, for example, or for example, pick me up from the train station or whatever it is. I can't do that. I have to go with the flow. I get invited, I get invited, and I'm just happy to be there. So I remember that journey. It was a 4 hour journey. I had the guy that was driving. He was just a friend, another friend. We had, and two of the speakers in this event, this conference on Sayyidina Fatima Zahra alayhi salam. In this event, two of the speakers sitting next to me. One was quite large, and the other one was like medium. So I'm sitting there, I kid you not, for 4 hours, right in the middle. Obviously, I had to be in the middle. You're not allowed to be on the sides because these guys are older than you. So I had to sit in the
You're the
middle.
youngest.
I was cramping up on my thighs. I had to listen to all of this conversation. I couldn't rest. I couldn't repair. I couldn't do anything. And I remember that was my first journey
You
up
paid
to
your
up to
dues.
Manchester. I paid my, listen, I've had my fair share of box of chocolates. Let me tell you this for free. I've had my fair share of box of chocolates. But look, it was an experience and I will never ever change it for the world, because it gave me the opportunity to see different communities, to recite in front of different people. It was a beautiful experience. So when I my yeah so my when I first started off in English recitations, I was suddenly being invited. So something was working, right? If I was diabolically bad, no one would have invited me. I think so. I don't know, maybe I was just filling the gap and people just needed at the time English recitations and they had no one else to pick. Maybe. I don't know, but I don't know. So I had my fair share of criticism, but the criticism came from those who are Iraqi. Let me explain. So I was doing the style of recitations that I don't know, probably I've answered all your questions, but I'm just going to keep talking until you tell me to stop, by the way. Yeah. So I'm just going to carry on talking. Anyway, so I the style that I recite is Iraqi Karbala'i traditional, right? Now this might make sense to you, it might not, I don't know. But say if we take Mulla Bassem, right? Mulla Bassem, right? Any one of his typical recitations is something that I copied in English, right? So the tone, the pace, because as you know, within Indo-Pak communities, their pace is different to the Iraqi. Iraqi is a lot slower than the Hodges or the Pakistanis, right? So to the Iraqis, it's like, hold on, I know that recitation, that's from Mulla Bassem, but you're doing a really terrible job at it, trying to do it in English, right? So that was the initial kind of like from the Iraqis. But if I look just further ahead, and that's an advice I can give to the younger ones, like your initial community ain't gonna like it because they know who you are. They know you, they know your parents, they know your personality, they see you every single week. So they may say, okay, this is great. But other communities outside, if you just look further than your own community, then maybe you have a chance. Maybe you have a chance. And that's very, very important, by the way, because a lot of people, especially the young reciters, when they start reciting and they have their immediate community giving them feedback, that's not, you take that with a pinch of salt. You say, okay, thank you, put it to the side. When you get invited to different communities, that's when you're like, okay, what is the feedback? And alhamdulillah, I got very positive feedback from people outside of my local community. That's where I was listening to. That's what I was hearing. So I was like, okay, this is working. Like something is going well. Like I was getting invites, and I was slowly, slowly graduating and developing into a English reciter. The great news for me, and this is where, again, a bit of a history lesson, the boom of like English majalis that started probably in the late 80s and early 90s, that's where I kind of took the opportunity, because there was suddenly every organization that was created wanted English recitations. They needed English recitations because a program is not complete without recitation, be it happy, be it sad. And so I was the only one doing English, so I was getting invites left, right, and center. Whether I was good or bad, I don't know, but they just needed to fill that gap. And so they needed to continue those programs. And that's where essentially I kind of not took advantage, but I basically, that's where I just kept getting invite after invite after invite, because obviously there was a need and I was reciting. There's a
So
lot more that I can say about that. I want to pause.
So as you started getting more invites and hopefully you traveled in better style, did you notice a difference in when you got invited to like the East African Khoja Jamaats? Or like, can you talk a little bit about the different places you got to travel to and the energy and the audience reception, whether it was the Lebanese community, the Arabic community, or the Khoja community, and how that was?
All right. So, yeah. So each audience and each country that I went to had a completely different feel to them. Whenever I went to East Africa, I mean, even in a country, if I go to two separate centers, has a different feel to it, right? So I could go to one center and I just mentioned the name Imam Ali, and all of a sudden you get SubhanAllah, 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 right? And there's other centers, and I'm killing myself. Really in tune with the poem, and I just get like a few smiles here and there. So it's very difficult. It's quite daunting. I ain't gonna say which community it was, but so there are some communities that are difficult, which you kind of just need to manage your expectations in terms of, and there are other communities. Look, I'll be honest again, just a bit of an insider knowledge, knowledge when it comes to reciters. We do look for communities that are passionate, that are loud, that are not shy to encourage. There are some communities that you go to, just the audience themselves, they encourage you to do better. It's not because some speakers or some reciters think, you know what, I want to go to this majlis and I want to make it an absolutely fantastic, reception, and I want it to be a buzz and stuff like that. You kind of need to fine-tune your intentions here. What are you actually doing this for? Are you doing this for to get people going crazy for the Ahlul Bayt, or are you actually doing this to say, when people say that, oh, do you know what? I remember that recitation. I remember that night. It was so fun. It was really all that stuff. You just kind of need to fine-tune your intentions a bit. Speaking of intentions, I'll speak about that later. There's an interesting story that kind of changed my perception on intentions. But anyway, so whenever I go to different communities, by the way, I've never been introduced to these communities before. So it was every single community from about 2012 up until about 2017, 18 was the first time that I've ever visited these communities. So I don't know what they're like. So each time it's like, what am I going to get from the first 1 minute? And so I started to develop ways to get them comfortable, number one, to bring out my personality, number two, and number three, just to gauge what kind of audience are you. Yeah, there was a couple of things that I would do. First and foremost, there is an introduction, but then I just speak to them as normal human beings. A lot of the reciters now, what they do is the moment they get on stage, if it's a happier conference, for example, the moment they get on stage, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, and they go straight into the poem. Brother, introduce, Salaam alaikum, make us feel at ease. Just connect with us as human beings, and then you'll get a much better reception. Yeah. So I was always comfortable speaking to the audience. I don't know why I was never shy to kind of speak to them. Yeah, sometimes I'll say things that are a bit like, what's that? Like waffling, basically, we call it. I don't know what you call it in American. What do you call waffling? Is there, do you
It's
have a word
waffling
called
is
waffling?
fine. Yeah, that's fine.
Waffling? Yeah. Okay, cool. So sometimes I would waffle, but like I was always comfortable speaking to an audience. And that kind of developed my career later on when it comes to TV and media work. But yeah, so I went, okay, so went to America. America has a very, very diverse community. Dearborn community, Assalamu alaikum, love you guys. Dearborn community by far was a fantastic community that I went to. They were always passionate. They always gave me like their responses and their clapping and
Of
all of that
course,
stuff. And even in the happy and in the sad as well, they were very receptive to this style of recitation, which was great. Other communities that I went to, it's a bit difficult, but again, this is all new to them, so it's new to me and it's new to them, right? So everything was just like, this is all like a learning curve. Like, what is this guy all about? What's he actually going to do? Because what they're used to is someone reciting in their language. They're not used to someone reciting in English. So when they see a reciter, it's like, is this guy reciting in English? Like some of the times when I get it's like, I actually get like people doing what? What's this? This is English. I understand it. And all of a sudden, they're thinking, children. I need my kids to sit here. I need the youth to sit here because that's where the connection happens. That's where the next generation. I had, subhanAllah, I had a young sister come up to me and she showed me a picture with her mum. She showed me a picture of when she was, I would assume, six or seven in Dearborn. Count 10 years later, she's now, mashallah, a 17-year-old. So she came and saw me with my mom. She said, "Brother Ali, do you remember me?" I was like, "I'm really sorry, I don't. Remind me." She goes, "Look at his photo." I'm like, "No way, that's you." So she grew up essentially listening to English recitation. She remembered me when she was seven, and then now she's 17, 18.
Mashallah.
So for them, so I grew up with these kids who are now adults. And I learned from them, and they learned from me. So it was like a learning curve. So anyway, I basically look for communities that give me passion. It doesn't mean I don't like going to other communities. By the way, I had a really humbling and a really, I'm going to choose my words carefully.
I'm waiting for it.
I had a really humbling but also very interesting experience. That was a major lesson for me when it comes to reciting for Hoja communities. It was in the UK. I don't know if some of the I don't know if anyone's heard this story before, but I was in the UK and I was reciting in a city called Birmingham, which is about 2 hours away from London. In the city, so interestingly, it was the youth committee that invited me, not the main executive committee, a committee. I don't know how many committees you guys have, but like there's like a youth committee and a finance community and executive committee,
We have a lot of
whatever it is, right?
committees.
You have a lot of committees, right? So I got invited by the youth committee, which was very important. Although they got permission from the EC to have this program, they had a very prominent speaker and they had a very prominent Arabic reciter there. His name is Abadar. You might actually heard of him. It's Mullah Abadar Halwaji. I think he's been to, Abadar, right? So Mullah Abadar was there. As he is the more senior, he came on after me. Interestingly, I came on first, and it was the birth of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. and I started reciting. Now, I started reciting, great reception. It was a mix of adults and youth. It's a very good family feel. A very good family feel. So I started reciting, but then I introduced something which is a big no-no in the Khawaja community, depending on where you go, and that's clapping. Yeah, I'm not going to get into the politics. Not going to get into the haram or
No.
halal. I don't care about that world, but I need to respect the fact that some centers just don't accept clapping. Yeah, fine. I didn't know that at the time. I genuinely didn't know. Like, I didn't know. But bear in mind, I'm a guest. Yeah, I'm a guest, and the first time I'm in this community. So here I am reciting. Everyone is coming along. Everyone is reciting with me. Everyone is clapping. And it was a really good atmosphere. Really good atmosphere. From the corner of my eye, I noticed someone who looked very, very agitated in the back of the hall. And
Oh.
he started to make his way down to next to me. So he stood next to me, and here I am reciting, and I'm looking to the left. I'm like, what does this guy
Is this
want?
guy? Yeah.
So he's like, please give me the microphone. Mid-recitation, I kid you not. Mid-recitation, please give me the microphone. I give him the microphone. By the way, bear in mind, everyone's like, what's happening
What's
now? So he
happening?
takes the microphone. He goes, for the sanctity of this Jamaat, we told the youth committee that there was no clapping. Please stop the clapping now. We told the youth committee. And then all of a sudden, there was pin drop silence. I was shocked, a number of reasons, but I remember very
Awkward.
vividly. I remember very vividly hearing the audience say, what is this? This is disgusting behavior. And it wasn't directed at me. It was
Oh,
directed
at
at
him.
person. Yeah, at him. Like, this is disgusting behavior. And I could hear some murmuring in the crowd. And then so then I said, so I was like, okay, assalamu alaikum jami'an wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And I came and sat down. Right. And then everyone's looking at each other thinking, what just happened?
What?
Like, he
Yeah.
literally dragged off the reciter from the stage, dragged him off. So I sat down. When I sat down, I was like, okay, I'm done. Like, I don't know what else to do. I mean, the only thing that I knew to answer is the clapping. So the host came on, the MC came on. He's like, Brother Ali, we sincerely apologize. Please, can you continue the recitation? Right? I'm like, no, I'm okay. Like, at this moment, like, listen, by the way, I'm young, I'm emotional, right? And I'm
Yeah.
raw. And I'm like, I'm choking back tears because I've never been in this situation before. Yeah, it was scary. Like, look, I'm 18, 19 years old here. Yeah. So I'm completely, in this new community. I don't know what's going on. I just got dragged off the stage. No mama, no baba, no one to support me. I was like, hey, what's going on here, right? I'm about to cry. I didn't know what's going on. So he goes, please come back on. Please come back. So I went back on, and I just said, look, brothers, I didn't mean to offend anyone.
Yeah.
I genuinely didn't know, but I'm a guest in this community, and I hope that, please accept my sincere apologies. When I recited again, by the way, obviously no clapping. I wish I could find this video, because there was fire in my eyes. I was so angry that it came across as very angry, even in the presentation. Yeah, that was a funny experience. So then I started to say, okay, before I go to any Khawaja community, salamu alaikum, alaikum salam, do you accept clapping? Most of the time they'll be very blunt and say, listen, guys, no clapping. I'm like, okay, I respect that. Just tell me beforehand. Yeah, just tell me beforehand. Some communities were very challenging, and they're like, yes, we're gonna have clapping. We don't care what happens, even if someone tries to drag you off the stage, we're gonna fight for you, and all that stuff, right? Because there is an argument that's going on, like, is it haram, is it halal? But that's only within the Khawaja community. It doesn't happen outside. Lebanese, Iraqi, whatever you want, we have that's
Only the
part and parcel of
Khojas.
our. Yeah, it's part. Look, it's not a criticism. I understand. I genuinely do understand the premise behind it. From my perspective, all I was saying is, like, look, your kids are enjoying this. Your kids are actually benefiting from coming to the mosque. Most of the time, they come to the mosque, they listen to some foreign language, don't have a clue what's being said, they don't care what's being said, they just can't wait to go home, or can't wait to go outside, or can't wait to do something other than sit down in the madrasa. At least with English recitations and a bit of clapping, it's fun for them. Like, there's no reason why making the mosque fun within the boundaries of Islam. I'm not saying, like, just get up and dance or anything like that, but just being a bit more forward thinking to understand, let's make it a bit more of an enjoyable experience. So Iraqis, 10-10. Wherever I go, they always give you full attention, full passion. Lebanese, I went to Australia. So I went to, in terms of the countries I've been to, Australia. I did a week there, only because you need 2 days to get there and 2 days to get back. So especially I was living in the UK. So that was an interesting experience. I went to two or three different centers there. They're okay. Sorry, Lebanese guys, they're okay when it comes to the, they don't really know, because they don't have that many prominent, I'm gonna eat my words later on. They don't
Yeah,
have that
I
many
don't
prominent, yeah.
know.
Okay, they do, but
Careful.
like it's not part and parcel of the. Actually, do you know what? Let's just
Yeah,
park that to the
it's
side. Yeah,
fine.
that's fine. It's fine.
Yeah, it's
I
great.
love you guys. Great. Yeah.
Everyone's
So,
good.
Africa, whenever I go, I never ask for clapping. I don't do clapping. I don't even go near clapping. When I go to Tanzania, actually, I stand corrected. I went to a organization called ABIS, and they had a program for Imam Hussein called the Elixir or Elixir of Love. Quite a magical name, but anyway, there the person that the organizer of the program, she said to me, Ali, no matter what happens, you clap, you make people clap, all right, and we'll put background instrumentals. We wanted to go all out because it was the key point here that it wasn't in the jamaat. If it's inside the jamaat, all laws apply. Outside the jamaat, all laws are lifted. Basically, you can do what you want, but because it's outside the jamaat, people clapped and people really enjoyed it. And it was in Tanzania,
Dar, yeah.
right? In
Tanzania,
Dar.
sorry.
So it's like in the belly of the beast, basically, when it comes to anti-clapping, right? So that was quite an interesting experience. Bit of backlash here and there. Okay, no problem. I got over it. It's fine. But in terms of backlash, interestingly, I don't know if this is a question that you might want to ask, but I introduced, I guess, the first Western style recitation. I don't know if you've heard of it, called Haya. Actually, you could just say, just nod your head, say yes, so you don't. Anyway, this was, it was very, very anti-establishment. It was very anti-status quo. It was very out there when it comes. By the way, if you listen to it now, it's like, really, it's not that bad. But 13 years ago, 14 years ago, that was like completely different to your normal lakmiyat. If I can whisper it, it was like a song, basically, but
Got
yeah,
it.
it was just like it was different. It
Okay.
was just different. Speaking of communities, so I don't know if it was a mistake. I don't know if I owned it. I don't know if like what I was young, and then I so basically this guy, he his name is Mohsin. He Pakistani heritage. He did a lot of Western style delivery of songs for Imam Hussein. He just didn't look into, he didn't care about the Jama'ah. He didn't care about what was, he just said, look, for us to be able to really connect, that's his thinking. Yeah. Whether it's right or wrong, let's park that to the side. His thinking is like, look, whether we like it or not, youngsters listen to music. They just listen to music, whether we like it or not. Right? It's just part and parcel of the culture. They listen to everything. They know all of the names. They know all of the songs. So why don't I don't care about, the rights and wrongs and the halals and the haram. I want these kids, at least if they're going to listen to something, let me give them an alternative. Yeah. So he produced songs basically about Imam Hussein and Ahl Bayt. Personally, when I listened to them, I'm like, wow, this is actually quite good. Right? It was interesting to listen to. Anyway, so he came up to me and he says, listen, Ali, I've got an idea for you. Here's a song. I'm going to be straight up, right? Here's a song. I wrote it. It's called Higher. And it was very, very not your typical Latmiya. I was expecting a Latmiya, but it was, the tone wasn't the same. The pace wasn't the same. And I'm thinking to myself, how in the world can I recite this? Like, I don't know how to recite this. But he pushed me to it. He said, I know you can do it. I did maybe 19 takes, 20 takes of this thing until it came to what it is now. And if I listen back to it, technically, I still am all over the place. But it came to a semi-decent standard. That changed the whole atmosphere when it comes to English recitation. It really did. Yeah, it really did. Because what happened then is that, okay, people started to notice English in the form of, or like recitations. And they said, okay, your normal typical Iraqi style can only benefit a certain audience. But if you're doing it in this style, then this can affect any audience in the world. Fun fact, actually, I put this track on a back in the day, we used to have message boards. I don't know if you're a part of like, do you remember Shia Chat?
Oh
Shia Chat. You had to
yeah.
make a username and a password and an account, and you just talk
You can
about
talk and ask questions and all
so
these
many
other
different topics.
things.
Yeah, right. So anyway, so there was a message board which I found online, which basically other singers and other singers and producers, they reflect on and give feedback on anonymous songs. So I put the song on. I was like, these guys aren't Iraqi, they're not Shia, they're not Muslim. But I put this track onto that, and I asked people to review it. The response that I got, and by the way, it was about Muhammad Hussein, about Karbala. The response that I got was like, this is a sad song of someone who's lost a loved one. That actually connected with someone. That connected with someone with that. Like the name Imam Hussein was mentioned three or four times. The name Karbala was mentioned three or four times. But the idea was there. The theme was there to connect with someone that's not Muslim. That's the whole idea. That's the whole point. If I so there are two types of recitations that you want to do. One, catering for the Shia population, and two, try and do something that caters for a worldwide audience. Why not? Imam Hussein's message is universal, as we always say on the pulpit, right? So why not create content that is universal for everyone? So the feedback was like, this sounds like a love song, and someone that's lo lost someone who's really dear to him. And I'm like, you've hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what it is. I have lost Imam al-Hussein, and I yearn to be with Imam al-Hussein. He is a loved one, and it is a song about me losing a loved one. That's literally word for word what it was, right? But it connected to a different audience. Now going back to, sorry, different audiences that I've been to. This particular audience that I was reciting for 10 nights in Muharram, we wanted to release the track, but there was a video as well on the, I think it was night 8 of Muharram, and it was typically the nights that they remember Qasim, son of Imam Hassan alayhi salam, in the Iraqi schedule. I know that obviously different
It's
communities have
different,
different schedules on who
yeah.
they commemorate, right? So, but what we did was we had a big screen come down, and the video was shown, right? And I'm standing behind the screen. I'm like losing my head in fear, like I don't know what the reaction is going to be. So they played the video, and everyone was stunned. Everyone was silent. And then my worst nightmare came to life when a few people within the audience started to laugh. Yeah. Now, this is Muharram, don't forget, right? This is a very ritualistic, traditional 10 nights of
Eighth night of
Iraqi
Muharram.
style, eighth night of Muharram, right? And this is Qasim night. So typically, this is the youth night. And people started laughing in the majlis. And then I wanted the floor to swallow me because I'm like, what in the world have I done? Right? What have I done? I'm making people laugh in the majlis? Oh my God. Like, this is horrible. By the end of it, even worse, people give me a round of applause and people start to clap. And I couldn't believe what I had done. But that was just the initial reaction. The reaction afterwards, I had my a neighbor who was three doors down, that the only thing I would say to them, they were Iraqi as well, the only thing I would say to them is Salam alaikum salam. No, come to mind, you come. We're not even close, right? We're not close like that. The mum of that family sent me a message saying, Salam alaikum Ali, how are you? How are you? All that stuff. She goes, fantastic recitation. Really, really great. We really need stuff like that. I had messages like raining in. Some of them were bad. Look, I'll be very, very honest with you. Some of them people said, look, this is no place for Shia Islam. There is no place for this kind of stuff. Blah, 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 blah. You're going to get backlash. And that's why, I mean, the whole fear, no fear, it came from that age. Like, I was not scared to try something new. And I did try something new. Look, I'm not scared to try Urdu, for example. I'm not scared to try a different language, Iranian. I'm not scared to put on a certain type of dress because I don't care about people's perceptions and stuff. That proved to me that actually there is a silent crowd out there that appreciate things that are not just the status quo. And that's like, okay, there is an audience out there. So yeah, going back to your question in terms of different audiences, I've alhamdulillah seen a lot, and they're all fantastic, all 10/10. Not gonna say
All
anything
are
bad about any of
great.
them. Yeah.
So talk to us about the Shia voice, which has gained popularity beyond probably what maybe you have even imagined. How did you get involved with it, and what are your experiences with it? Do you have any memorable contestants? I just saw a video of someone, I think it was someone from the UK, Adam Khalfan, who actually almost passed out when he was on stage. Could you tell us a little bit about the behind the scenes, your interactions with the judges?
So remember when I said early in the talk that I was never shy or afraid to speak to an audience, whether I waffled or not, said something meaningful or not, was funny or not, I don't know. But I was never shy in terms of speaking in front of a camera or speaking in front of hundreds of people or 10 people. That then developed into actually not being shy in front of a camera. So whenever there's a camera in front of me, I don't get shy, or I don't get nervous. Everyone gets nervous, but like I would still be able to hold a conversation if a camera's in front of me, i.e. this whole conversation here, for example, right? So that then developed into people inviting me to host TV shows, namely Imam Hussein TV, who are the creators of the Shia Voice. So for a number of years, I was the kind of presenter for certain TV shows on the channel, and that also extended to emceeing certain events before Shia Voice. So I would travel as well. Just li so I've traveled to countries just to emcee. Not even they haven't invited me as a reciter. Actually, Oman was one of them. They didn't like this year. I technically was there to MC the Friday event and the Saturday event, and unfortunately I wasn't there for the Sunday event with Mehdi Hassan. But so I was there to MC, right? So I think for them they just needed someone to calm people's nerves, be a bit of an interesting personality, and also just be relatable, because this is a type of show that you needed someone, as soon as these contestants come onto the stage, they feel comfortable around people. Either I didn't want to be awkward, or I didn't want to stutter, or I didn't want to make so the I don't know if this is a good analogy, but how do you know if a referee has had a good game in a soccer match when you don't mention him, when you don't mention anything to do with him? Because you know that he's done his job perfectly. He isn't the main focal point. And I just felt like I don't want to be the focal point. I don't want to be the one that's giving judgment. And I don't want to be the one that's obviously a contestant, right? I don't want to overshadow the contestant, and I don't want to. So I just want to be the person that just smoothly organizes everything so that the show can blossom, right? And I felt the channel put a lot of confidence in me, and I really do appreciate the opportunity. And I appreciated the idea, because at first, I'll be very honest, when I heard Shia Voice talent show, I'm like, it's a talent show? Like, really? I'm just gonna come up, get up and recite poetry. Is that like what is it? But then when I was there for the organizing and I was there for the production, I'm like, hold on, no, this is not gonna be normal. This is gonna be life-changing for a lot of people. This is going to change the scene, the atmosphere of Shia English multimedia or Shia English television production for life. Right. This is going to change the world when it comes to Shia television. And I'm like, okay, I want to be part of this. So I was happy to be part of it. And I'll tell you what, people had the same perception that I had in the first two episodes when we were recording, because not a lot of people turned up. And I'll put my hands up and say it, and I'd be very proud to say not a lot of people turned up because they were like, talent show, what's going on? They don't really know what's going on. We had like 50, 60 people in our first episode, and it was a bit demoralizing, but we had the confidence, and we knew that once people found out, actually, look at the production in this, like the cameras and the lights and the action and the all of that. It's like, wow, like this is great stuff for Shiite TV. You're not used to it. You're used to it on maybe mainstream Islamic channels might have it, but you're used to seeing this on, I don't know what your American equivalent of like BBC, I don't know, Fox News, NBC, whatever. I don't know what you have, but anyway, your mainstream channels, right? Your mainstream channels that will have these kind of entertainment shows, but this is happening on like a Shia perspective, the Shia light. This is fantastic stuff. It looks great. So, third episode, more and more people came, 100, 200, and all of a sudden, we were overflowing with audiences with audience, towards the night 7, 8, and 9, especially. So, and that's where people found out, okay, now this is a production. I want to be a part of this, and I actually want to go and see. Because a lot of the time, when it comes to family, or when you want to go with friends and you want to go out, where do you go? Typically to a restaurant, usually gathering, whatever. So you go to these different places. But this is like, okay, I want to go to my friends to go and watch a proper talent show, like a real, real talent show. And it was very entertaining for people. Entertaining, but within limit, within the boundaries of Islam. Nothing in that was outside the boundaries of Islam, no matter which way you look at it. No music, no this, no that, right? So for the first season, it was groundbreaking. I remember after Ramadan when it was shown, I used to see people in different communities saying, listen, like, well, Ali, we used to sit waiting for Shia Voice. They were in the UK, by the way. So we used to sit, we used to have futur, we used to wait, we sit as a whole family and debate between ourselves who was good,
Who is
what did Sayyid
gonna
Ammar say, what was Sayyid Jalal saying, what was Munna Nazar laughing at his comments, saying, all of these things. It's like it became a family conversation about something meaningful, right? And it wasn't as heavy as a lecture, right? Sometimes you need to sit there and concentrate on lectures. You need to really be in that mindset. But this you could just chill and just watch talents come on show, right? You don't know what's gonna happen next. You don't know what if it's gonna be a poem, if it's gonna be a recital, if it's gonna be a Quran, if it's gonna be a lecturer. You don't know what the judges are gonna say, and you're like expecting, okay, what are the judges gonna say this time? Sayyid Ammar throws in these curveballs and
Mullah Nazar
is
knows and
scaring.
throws in curveballs.
Yeah, but like for example, scaring the life out of Sister Nebat Bahar, for example, in the last season where he told her, listen, this is great, but you didn't even answer the question. It's like, oh my God, it's like really shocking moments, right? And that's what TV is all about. And that's what entertainment is all about. So I got into it because of my history within television anyway. At the channel, I actually presented my own late night show, where I had guests, and we would just talk about their life. We'll talk about something funny. We'll do a funny activity, for example. What did we do? We had headphones on. This whole Jimmy Kimmel Live, all that stuff like that. Basically, it was just, again, it was just light entertainment within the boundaries of obviously.
It's very fun. I have to tell you, we all tune in, and those of us across the pond, we do feel jealous because we don't get to, there's not a chance for us to attend
Yeah.
in the audience, but it's great fun, just to watch. So at
Yeah.
UMA this past year, you did a kids workshop, and just taking a peek in, even just meeting you, the kids were excited. Can you talk a little bit about that and what that experience was like for you, just meeting those little ones?
Yeah. So me and children go a long way back. Part and parcel of my passion for recitation is seeing the reaction on young children. And then I developed that further to say, because I've got children myself, so I it's a bit difficult because sometimes you're quite stern and disciplined with your own children, but you're really soft and comforting with other children. It's like, well, hold on, you need to do this here and not do it there. But anyway, so I managed to release the child in me with my children, because there's no judgment, no expectation, and my kids are used to me being quite fun, because I'm very much myself with them. It's quite fun to be around. Because there's so many, like when it comes to being a speaker or a reciter, there's such a status quo on what you have to look like and what you have to be like and what you have to say and what you have to present yourself as. And I don't know, some people criticize me saying, Ali, you're being a bit too childish. I'm like, do you know what? I don't care. I've never cared when I first started off, and I don't care now. I don't care what this community or this person says, you look childish. Mate, I really don't care. Because at the end of the day, am I affecting young children? Am I having a positive impact on young children? Am I connecting with the audience that I'm in front of? Sometimes I might be a bit, that's why I think why I encourage people to be themselves on stage is because people relate to that. And that's why, again, her voice is quite relatable because a lot of people, they listen to the background story of that person and say, I can be like that. Like I, you know, there's interesting, I don't know, I don't mean to go back to her voice, but there's interesting stories of people like, they came to Shia Voice because they weren't given an opportunity in the local community. So they wanted another opportunity, a platform for them to say, listen, this is me. I want to recite. I want to serve. This is the platform that I can do it. And since then, they got invites everywhere else because they weren't given an opportunity in their
MashaAllah.
local communities, right? So for me, I just want to encourage people to say, look, just be yourself on stage. Right, don't be a clown, but like just lighten up. That's all it is. Just lighten up, just relax. And because I have that in me, when it comes to children, I can be an absolute clown and I don't care what other people say. Recently, I worked with Imam Hussein Charity based in London. And so we were thinking of initiatives and ideas on how to get more contributions from audiences and from donors. And I said to them, look, I can very easily go to any one of their events and say, Salaamu Alaikum, can I give a 5 minute introduction into Imam Hussein Charity and just say, look, we need money. There's orphans,
Normal.
widows, the normal stuff, right? But I was like, do you know what? Why don't I create an initiative, an activity where communities almost feel like they have to have this in their center? So what I did was I created a story called The Prophetic Voyage. In The Prophetic Voyage, it's a story where I have to act out and I have to basically do all of this weird and wonderful stuff, explaining the story of prophets in the Quran. And then I said, why don't we? I can contact communities and say, look, there's this initiative. I can come to your center. I can deliver a storytelling session for young children. All you need to do is pay £300 or let's say $300. That will go towards charity. No fee involved, no travel fee, nothing like that. All you need to do is pay $300. That will go towards charity. Every dollar of that goes towards charity. And in return, I will come and do a storytelling session for your kids. It'll be a fun, informative, entertaining night for your children. And at the end of the day, you've contributed £300 to charity. It was a win-win situation, a no-brainer. I went to so many centers across the UK. The interesting thing about this is that when I come up onto the stage, or I'm sitting in front of the Jama'ah, or standing in front of the Jama'ah, or standing in front of whoever the kids are, they ranged, by the way, from like 20 to 300. I had an auditorium once, and that was quite an experience. An auditorium of kids, which I had to control and keep in check and keep focus for about 40 minutes, which was a major challenge. But anyway, so I would come up, Salaamu Alaikum, my name is Ali Fadhil, I'm here on behalf of Imam Hussein Charity. Few words on charity, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to call Amu Ali, who's going to come on stage now, and he's going to deliver the story. So then I go backstage, I put on a turban, Iraqi style, I put on a cloak, and then I come out and I'm completely a different person. Completely a different person. And that's where, look, I won't be shy to say it, in that character, that's where like my inner child comes out. And I can be completely myself without judgment. Because everyone knows that's a character. That's not the real Ali Fadhil, apparently. That's not the persona that speakers and reciters have. No, I could laugh and I could joke and I could take the mic and I could do what I want because I know it'll affect the kids. And the kids, their eyes were just wide open. Like it was really fun. It was one of the most enjoyable days of my kind of serving life. And I felt like actually, you know what? Let's develop this further. Let me do regular monthly kind of sessions where I can do storytelling sessions. Let me try and do YouTube videos. Obviously, it hasn't really materialized yet. I might work on it later on, but let me do storytelling sessions. You know, Miss Rachel? You heard of Miss Rachel? Yeah. So something in and around that. It's like she probably doesn't speak the way she performs, right?
No.
But I wanted to be myself, but I don't know what myself is. Is it that I'm Wiley character? Is that really myself, just a child basically? Or is it the whole persona where I have to be a reciter and be proper and be salamu alaikum, alaikum salam, surely, all of that stuff, right? So that's why I try to mix and match both of those personas when I'm on stage at Ummah or whatever conference that I'm at. I just want to be myself. Like there was a time where say Nadeem Sarwar, for example, he was on stage at Ummah, right? And then he turned to me and he was just saying words. I didn't understand a word he was saying. And his son was like, oh yeah, he just wanted to thank you. And I'm like, what? Say Nadeem is thanking me. So I turned to the audience and I'm like, listen guys, salamu alaikum. My life is complete. Say Nadeem has literally spoken to me. So
I
I'm like,
remember this.
yeah, so stuff, small things like that just makes you human. It just makes you human and it just makes you so relatable. So that's what I wanted to focus on. And when it comes to kids programs, I die for kids programs. I love their reaction. I love joking around with them. Sometimes they overstep their boundaries, but it's okay. They're just kids. And I like to see at the end of the session how much they've actually learned. And I was very, very, I wasn't surprised, but I was very impressed with the audience in Toronto because not only did they retain all the information that we threw at them in different forms, by the way, because we did quizzes, we did a video, we did audio only, we did a straight up talk, we did recitations, but they retained so much information. And it just said to me, I need to give a shout out to the Adventures of Muslim Kids. They're the ones that organized that program. Fantastic initiative. It's a podcast between two kids who basically have a conversation about life challenges, but from a kid's perspective, which
Same
I
for
found
that,
very,
yep.
very interesting. Yeah,
Yeah,
so it's
he's done a
yeah,
great
exactly. Yeah.
job.
So yeah, hats off to them for their great. And I really was grateful for that opportunity. Although it was in the afternoon, I could have stepped in, but I was like, you know what? Nope. Let me go do these sessions with the children.
This is great. Thank you so much for your time. We do like to end the podcast with one fun question. So, if you
Okay.
could travel on holiday anywhere in the world, non-religious, where would it be?
Okay.
Non-religious.
I was literally saying Karbala
Yeah,
as
you
you were
can't say
asking me the
Karbala,
question.
non-religious.
Non-religious holiday destination. Do you know what? I'm a very adventurous person. I don't know if star signs are a thing, but I read it ages ago when I was younger, and apparently Aries, they love an adventure. But okay, I'm not going to get into the whole star sign situation, but I do love an adventure. So I really like the jungle. Like I really want to go kind of backpacking, just not caring, not
Roughing
having my
it.
phone. Yeah, just proper roughing it
Roughing
out,
it.
living in
Wow.
camps, living in tents, whatever it is, just going to rainforests and just climbing up stuff and just seeing animals and fearing for my life, that kind of adrenaline. Yeah, that kind of, I mean, oddly enough, I don't know why I'm going to mention this, but I'm going to mention it anyway. My lifelong kind of like dream was to go and study chimpanzees. No one knows this about me. I was fascinated when I was young. Again, interesting story. My mom, I told you my mom had a very tight, she had
Grip
a
on
tight
you.
ship. I forgot what the word was. But her agenda, her schedule was like on point.
Yeah,
If
tightening
it
ship on you.
reached nine, yeah, if it reached 9 p.m. and I'm not in bed, I'm in trouble. I need to go up by 8:30. She doesn't care if you're reading a book, reading a magazine. Back in the day, it was magazines. I didn't have a phone, didn't have a laptop, didn't have anything digital. So you could either be reading a book, you could stare at the ceiling. She doesn't care. You have to be in bed by 9. So one time we were watching a documentary, and it started at 8:15. I remember it started at 8:15-ish. No, actually 8:30, right? She got distracted. She went upstairs and left me downstairs to watch this documentary. It was about chimpanzees. And my dad loves nature. He loves the fact that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created a whole ecosystem out there that they interact in such a way That's really, really fascinating. For me, anyway, it was fascinating. So I kind of took that from when I was sitting there watching with my dad. My dad got distracted, he went upstairs. My mom got distracted with something else. And all of a sudden, by 9:15, I'm still downstairs. Yeah. So I'm still downstairs. And I'm like, it's 9:15. Like, I don't know what to do. I just carried on watching because I was so fascinated. What was happening on the TV was that chimpanzees, and I remember specifically what was the social dynamic. It was basically a mother-in-law giving grief to a daughter-in-law,
Oh.
and this wallah wallah, and the son was just minding his own business, he didn't care. But they specifically said these are the social dynamics, the family dynamics that even chimpanzees go through.
So
And
it's out there
since
as
then,
well.
hell yeah, hell yeah. And since then I was just so fascinated by it that I loved geography in class. I loved biology in class, especially with biology when it comes to like marine biology and biology where ecosystems and stuff like that. I was just fascinated by the outside world. So if I'm gonna answer the question, is I want to go backpacking.
Very nice answer. Brother Lee, thank you so much for sharing your journey with us. Your dedication to the community and contributions give us so much hope for the future. You've set an example that many of us can learn from. To our listeners, we hope this conversation has provided you with a deeper understanding of the roots of our community here in North America and the hard work that goes into building and sustaining it. At NACIMCO, we are committed to celebrating leaders like Brother Ali and fostering connections that strengthen our community for generations to come. We invite you to continue this journey with us as we bring you more inspiring stories from across the continent. Thank you for watching, and until next time, Assalamu alaikum.